Strange. Punks and Drunks and Flicks and Kicks. Written and read by Richard Strange. Episode 12. By now, Mark Dean had arrived from London for his first visit to New York, and he looked like his mum had dressed him and told him not to talk to any strangers. I had good audiences because I was sharing a bill with Tuxedo Moon, a band with a good cult following of their own, and Michael Zilka seemed very pleased with the results. The record cost him less than $2,000 to make, including the cost of mixing. The engineer simply recorded a stereo feed from my Revox tape recorder, plus my vocals, my guitar, and two microphones on the audience. There is something patently absurd about recording a live album that uses backing tapes, and that really appealed to my sense of the ridiculous.
It's raining in the darkness of the city. Girls' voices rip the silence to shreds. There's no anger, just excuses for pity. There's no strings and you just pick up the threads.
Michael dipped a little deeper into his pocket and had the shows videoed and got a director, Ed Steinberg, to produce a promotional video for one of the songs, International Language. We shot some additional footage for it in his apartment, and Christina appears in the finished film looking radiant as a tragic suicide on an unmade bed. Always a rather uncompromising and unpredictable girl, she showed me her wardrobe and asked me what I would like her to wear for the shoot from her impressive collection. We chose a few things and I left saying, "Whichever of those you feel most comfortable with be fine, any of them except the yellow dress." I asked her to arrive at the location for 7:30. At 10 o'clock, she arrived in the yellow dress. In the 20 years since then, I have known people miss flights, trains, concerts and hospital appointments and threaten murder and suicide because of Miss Monet's rather fleeting acquaintance with punctuality. Invariably, her late arrival is accompanied by a story that fabulously details a highly unlikely baroque chain of disaster and misfortune. That she is a genius and one of life's true originals is beyond reasonable argument. That she can be a pain in the arse and impossible to work with is equally incontrovertible. She does look great on film, though. No major record company could have turned the project round in less than 3 months. Michael did it in a month without even appearing to break sweat. We put together a press release and a few photos, and he was already thinking about his next project. He asked me what we should call the album. I suggested The Live Rise of Richard Strange, since it featured half the songs from the Phenomenal Rise project, and I wanted to use it as a teaser for the full-length studio version. I played a few more shows in New York over the next couple of weeks. I was finding it increasingly difficult to leave the city. I'd really fallen in love with the place. My favourite place to hang out and play was a club called Danceteria, on an upper-floor industrial space on West 21st Street. Ruth Polsky, a booking agent based in New York, offered to get me a few gigs, and Danceteria were keen to do some shows. It worked out well. I only wanted to keep enough money to keep myself afloat while I was there and to try and build a profile in New York. Danceteria was the hippest and the most loose of all the Manhattan music clubs that month. It was reached by a small cage lift, something like a Hitchcock movie, and although it was staffed by a hot-panted bellboy, the ascent to the club would routinely be accompanied by the rapturous groans of a fornicating couple whose lust had overtaken them in transit. The place was owned by a blonde German guy called Rudolf and his pneumatically voluptuous wife, the model and singer Diane Brill. They held nightly court in the club's VIP lounge like a mythical couple from the golden days of Hollywood. Most of Danceteria's day-to-day admin was handled by Jim Ferrat, a fellow with a fervent music fetish. He'd had impressively Catholic taste in music and booked acts as diverse as the rockabilly Levi Dexter and the Ripcords, the experimental Suicide and Tuxedo Moon, the mongrel jazz of James Blood Ulmer and the infectious salsa of Tito Puente. Thanks in no little part to Ferrat, it was the most happening club in New York. It was at Danceteria a year later that Madonna first came to the public's attention, in 1981, when the house DJ, Mark Kamins, started playing her tapes. It was Kamins who took Madonna's demo to Sire Records and produced her first club hit, Everybody. There was so much great music around in New York then, and As an English musician, I could always somehow get onto the guest list to see the bands I wanted when they played in the city. I saw the Waitresses and the Bush Tetras play at the Peppermint Lounge on West 45th, and the magnificent Bavarian oddball Klaus Nomi perform his castrati opera excerpts at a dismal club apparently called Exile on Long Island. I met Nomi on my way to Z Records one day. We had coffee together. We talked about his days at the Deutsche Oper in Berlin, where he worked as an usher, and he told me how he always wanted to be a singer. He was eventually sacked for demanding that he should take over the lead role one night when the diva was indisposed, insisting he was a far better singer than the replacement soprano.
What power art thou?
He was a truly delightful, articulate man, passionate about his music beneath his Rocky Horror meets the Bauhaus shtick. He was the first man I knew personally who died from AIDS in August 1983. Sadly, he was not to be the last. Eventually, with all the preparations for the release of the live Rise of Richard Strange completed, my stay in the USA came to an end. Michael told me that he and Christina would be coming to London in a few weeks, and we would stay in touch by telephone and fax until then. I packed my bag, gathered up all the gifts I'd bought for Renee and Gino on my trip, the baseball jackets, the cowboy boots, and all the souvenirs and records and press cuttings I'd accumulated, and spent a last evening with Christina and flew home. Arriving back in London after being away for so long was a jolt to the system. A combination of culture shock, anticlimax, jet lag, and fearful depression conspired to send me into a spin. After the initial homecoming, the distribution of the gifts and the telling of the news about the tour and Z Records, I became withdrawn and non-communicative. Anyone who's been away on tour knows how strange this feeling is. While you're on the road, you're without responsibilities, without history. You can be whoever you want because no one ever knows you, no one's ever met you. It's a truly liberating feeling to be able to reinvent yourself every day in a new town, to wake up, adopt an accent, a persona, an attitude, and try it on for size with your first cup of coffee. Slowly I adapted back to my life in London, the life of a man with a partner and a child, and Renee gave me the space to do it on my own terms. She was happy to share my excitement and to immerse herself in her own work as an illustrator. She knew, as women instinctively know, and Rena's more instinctive than most, that I had not been faithful to her, but she didn't make a big deal out of it. It must have been hard for her, though, every time I enthused about how great Christina was. Gino, by now 4.5 years old and as bright as a button, was an absolute joy at that age. He loved my music and my stage clothes of trench coat and slouch hat, and would entertain himself for hours in his room with an old tape recorder, a raincoat and a hat so big you could barely see his mouth under it, let alone his eyes. Phonetic snatches of my lyrics would emanate from his room, and once in a while, at a particularly dynamic point in the show, he would hurl a pack of playing cards in the air, just as I did on stage, and shout, "Premonition!" Michael and Christina came to London as agreed, and I met up with them a few times. The record was ready for release in the States, and Michael told me that the buzz was good. I knew that some copies would naturally come to Europe as imports, but he was aware that I didn't want him to release it in Europe in case it prejudiced my chance of getting a record deal with a studio version of the phenomenal Rise of Richard Strange. He asked after my future plans, and I told him I was going to write some songs with Christina, and that I also had an idea about opening a sort of mixed media club in London. He thought that sounded interesting and suggested I met with Mary Harron, who was an old friend of his from Oxford, who was freelancing for the BBC television arts programme The Late Show. Mary, a Canadian, had impeccable credentials. Before working in TV, she was a rock journalist. She helped start Punk, the first punk magazine, and was the first North American journalist to chance her arm at interviewing the Sex Pistols when no one cared to or dared to. She wrote a history of the Velvet Underground for New Musical Express, as well as a history of Andy Warhol and the Factory for Melody Maker. Additionally, she was a music critic for The Guardian, a theatre critic for The Observer, and a television and rock critic for The New Statesman. We met several times, and as I explained to her the sort of cabaret club that was evolving in my mind, she was enormously encouraging and supportive. "It sounds great," she said. It's just like the sort of cultural kick-up the arse this town needs." She assured me that if I got it off the ground, she would make sure it got media coverage. "Was she a girlfriend of yours, Oxford?" I asked Michael Zilka later. "No," he replied. "She hung out with a creep called Tony Blair." Mary was an extraordinary woman, intelligent and analytical, and she was easily carried away with the excitement, enthusiasm and madness of being a fan too. Her irrepressible energy served her well in the 90s, by which time she decided to be a filmmaker. In 1996, she wrote and directed the excellent film I Shot Andy Warhol, the story of Valerie Solanas, the writer of the feminist Scum Maggot Manifesto, who tried to kill Andy Warhol in 1968. Never one to play it safe, she followed up with a film of one of the most controversial books of the decade, Bret Easton Ellis's American Psycho, a horrendously difficult book to film and to read. I thought the finished film was well made, and the sinister, predatory Christian Bale and the superb young actress Chloe Savini both giving impressive performances, but ultimately the film was unsatisfying since it suffered from all the same shortcomings of the book. It wasn't quite sure if it was a satire or a gore-fest splatterpick, and consequently fell somewhere in between. While I was turning the cabaret idea over in my head, I decided I wanted to put together a nucleus of musicians who would record the studio version of The Phenomenal Rise with me, and do some gigs where the budget and the venue permitted. Mark Dean, Brian Morrison's helper, the kid who really discovered George Michael, told me he had three friends in Watford who had a band called The Quiffs. He said they looked good and they could play okay, but their music was going nowhere, and suggested I consider using them for my backing band. I thought it was a good idea and suggested that we meet as soon as possible. A couple of days later, the three of them turned up, looking painfully young and nervous. I sat them down and chatted to them, outlined the concept of the album, then played them a few songs on an acoustic guitar. Peter O'Sullivan, the bass guitarist, seemed to be the most self-confident. Angus McLean, who played guitar, was frail and shy. And Rob Sutton, the second guitarist, was brash and brattish and abrasive in a way that marked him out for early departure. I told them that they had to be absolutely dedicated to me, that they would have to work like demons and be prepared to have a lot of fun for very little financial reward. They all thought about it long and hard for about 5 seconds and said, yes. I telephoned Drumbo to tell him that I had a band and wanted him to be the drummer. I was delighted when he agreed. We rehearsed in a studio owned by Andy Schizowski in Clink Wharf near London Bridge. The boys were as good as their word. They arrived on time, worked hard, and did as they were told. Angus was the most musically gifted of the three, able to take a simple guitar part and make it sound oblique and new. Sadly, he was given to wearing a grey cardigan, which made him look like an 18-year-old middle-aged insurance salesman. Pete got by with a lot of enthusiasm and the ability to throw good shapes and hit the right notes more often than not. Pete was very into the new romantic thing and wore huge, voluminous trousers that made him look like a galleon under full sail. Sutton was more old-style rock and roll, one of a million kids who wanted to be Keith Richards, and thought there was nothing more to it than playing with a cigarette jammed in the corner of your mouth. Drumbo was solid as a rock and brought his unique good humour, intelligence and practicality to the enterprise. He even took my insistence that he shave off his prize handlebar moustache in good part, thinking I was joking. He quickly realised I wasn't and arrived at a rehearsal one morning clean-shaven and consequently looking half naked. It was a truly heroic sacrifice on his part. Within a couple of weeks, we'd worked out all the songs for the studio album and had banged them into pretty good shape. We were all feeling pretty good about the noise we were making. And when Z Records released The Live Rise of Richard Strange in autumn 1980, it did wonders for our morale when the reviews started to come in. The New Musical Express wrote, "The Live Rise of Richard Strange is the US shortened version of his soon-to-be-recorded political fantasy. The chance to hear the work in progress before the complete opus arrives is comparable to hearing the first draft readings of The Wasteland. Even I thought that was a slight exaggeration. Sounds enthused, I Won't Run Away, a sentimental and gloriously defiant ballad, is one track that convinces me that Strange isn't just another musician with a novelty publicity angle. Stage character and live person unite, and some of the pain and determination required for such an enterprise chokes its way out of the grooves. The Live Rise gets 5 stars because Strange has proved he has the guts and the energy to go out and do something dramatically different. Zigzag's Ian Blake wrote, "The song, The Phenomenal Rise of Richard Strange, is a song brilliant in its simplicity, while I Won't Run Away could well become one of the great torch songs of the 80s. I rate The Live Rise of one of the first great albums of this decade." Wow. I set up a few low-key gigs out of town to try out the band away from the prying eyes of the music press, and in October we did our first show in London at the Scala Cinema. We topped the bill of one of the enormously popular all-nighters that were promoted there each month. 6 or 7 bands would play on one of these extravaganzas, and they quickly became the most prestigious showcase a band could do in London. The hordes who came to every show were a baroque collection of white-faced, bouffanted, velvet-clad goths and new romantics. Both the audience and the bands were sustained by vast chemical intake, and there was a wonderful sense of communality and common purpose. I made sure that we had the prime spot around 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning before people started to drift away to catch the night bus or to start to go on the nod. We hammered the set hard, augmented on a few songs by Dave Winthrop's sax, and the rasping and wheezing of his playing added an edge that greatly enhanced some of the songs. The reviewer from Sounds magazine enthused, "Strange carries off a dangerous idea with class and professionalism, a sizzling set, enough elastic to wind up compulsive foot tappers, visual entertainment and food for thought for the timeout intellectuals. The single, International Language, should make a dent in the charts, and Strange's concept should be investigated by all concept goers." The applause at the end of our 50-minute set was rapturous, and I knew we were on our way. The fact that the guest list showed that Spandau Ballet, Adam and the Ants, Simple Minds and Michael Moorcock had all been there that night only added to my feeling of satisfaction. The journalist Jessamy Calkin was as enthusiastic as Sounds had been. She wrote in Record Mirror, "Then came the brilliant Richard Strange. It became immediately obvious that here is a professional, despite the fact that his band had only been together for a few weeks. Tall and thin in ravaged evening wear and dark glasses, he's a very physical and imaginative performer, combining confidence and a nicely sick sense of humour on stage. I was convinced that before too long, major record companies would be beating a path to my door, telling me how much they love the Doctors of Madness, yeah, and offering vast sums of cash for the privilege of releasing The Phenomenal Rise of Richard Strange." On the 9th of December, Renee and I were woken by our radio alarm, which seemed to be playing an inordinate number of Beatles songs. It was not until the end of a 4-record Beatles sequence that we learned why. A presenter interrupted the music to announce the news that John Lennon had been murdered the night before in New York, and we listened in stunned disbelief. The announcement recounted the bald facts of the murder, that John and Yoko were coming home from a late recording session. Outside their apartment block, the Dakota Building, Lennon was hailed by a fan to whom he'd given an autograph earlier that day, Mark David Chapman. Lennon turned, and Chapman shot him 5 times with a .38 revolver. He was rushed to hospital, but pronounced dead on arrival from a massive loss of blood. We were truly devastated. Lennon had been so much part of our growing up together that it really felt like losing a limb. The grief fest that followed was unseemly and crass, with Brian Ferry's cynically opportunistic release of the Lennon song Jealous Guy, which gave the aging Lothario a number one hit, probably the most sickening act of cashing in imaginable. I'd given my cabaret club idea a lot of thought, and throughout November I searched for a venue. I was incredibly fortunate to find a smoky gay Soho bar in Rupert Street called the Latin Quarter, with an appropriately down-at-heel decadent feel and an avaricious but adventurous proprietor. I negotiated a deal with him and Cabaret Futura was born. I opened Cabaret Futura on the 14th of December 1980 and I closed it on the 25th of May 1981. In those 6 months, the club was host to many of the most interesting and adventurous artists working in live performance at the time. Its success was wholly due to a new mood of participation, replacing the entertainment as spectator sport ethos, which had prevailed for so long. What made it unique was its accessibility to artists and its highly charged atmosphere of expectancy, which seemed to lift performances from the mediocre to the magical, and from the stage-bound to the sublime. It was in New York that I really started to get the idea for Cabaret Futura. At that time, there were some very exciting performing arts spaces in Manhattan, places like Kitchen, PS1, the Artist Space, and the Franklin Furnace, would all have regular events featuring the likes of Laurie Anderson, or the dancer-choreographer Carol Armitage, the avant-garde composer-musician Rhys Chatham, and the proto-punk stand-up monologuist Eric Bogosian. I had the idea to present this sort of collaborative and fringe work in a mutated European cabaret environment. Arriving back in London from New York, still flying on an adrenaline, I didn't even consider the difficulties involved in running a weekly club that would feature anything up to 10 different acts performing in a number of different media on any given night. I just thought it was a great time. After all the cynicism and the nihilism of late punk, art was cool again. It was a case of needing somewhere for myself to play and, since it didn't yet exist, inventing it. I told the journalist Simon Fellows at the time, rock clubs pride themselves on the pathetic perpetuation of crass rituals and stale values, which are of no use to me. I did all the administration from home, booking acts and organising equipment, with Rini helping out with artwork and publicity. I remember the agonising wait to see if anyone would actually show up on that first freezing December Sunday night. The lineup for the first night was eclectic. An extravagantly bequiffed Richard Jobson reading poetry, he had rather freely adapted from Sylvia Plath and Marguerite Duras. A two-piece synthesiser band called Blancmange, a mime artist whose name I no longer remember. Stand-up comedian, now actor Keith Allen, who performed naked with a steak and kidney pie that he fashioned to in a surreal Lord Charles-type glove puppet. And Rini and I performed a four-minute-long dance performance version of the D.M. Thomas novel The White Hotel, which she had choreographed and I'd written some deconstructed music for. Christina, still in London, had agreed to perform something. It was to have been her only London show, but characteristically some real-life, last-minute Madame Bovary-inspired drama intervened and she didn't make it. The atmosphere that night was excited and conspiratorial, and enough people turned up to cover costs. Although, if everyone I have subsequently met who assured me that they were there that night had actually turned up, I would have needed to have booked the Albert Hall instead. After an actual as well as a proverbial month of Sundays, we transferred to Monday nights in a much larger room downstairs. Although it was the same building, it had a different entrance and a different address, 13 Wardour Street. It is this place that I always remember now when I think of Cabaret Futura, down a tacky mirrored staircase to a small lobby, all gilt and red flock wallpaper like a Louisiana whorehouse, where our enchanting door girl, Giuseppina de Camillo, would meet and greet. She always arrived at work accompanied by her pet, an 11-foot-long python named Sainsbury, who would lay dreamily coiled at her feet under the cash register for the entire evening. Once past the slumbering serpent, the guests would pass through a small archway and into the main performance room, dimly lit with a small raised stage with steps leading up from the floor. Tables and chairs ranged halfway back, a pall of blue cigarette smoke over the bar, and the exquisite thrumming of gossip was everywhere. It had always been my intention to style the physical space of the club on the German model immortalised, if not invented, by Auden and Isherwood. In her book Cabaret, the writer Lisa Appignanese wrote in 1984, "Of all the cabarets to spring up in Britain over recent years, it is Soho's Cabaret Futura, the brainchild of Richard Strange, which bears the most atmospheric resemblance to its Weimar kin." Cabaret Futura became the focus and the meeting place for the energy that fed the explosion in fashion, photography, filmmaking and music. More than that, it suggested a reaction to television, the growing demand for a live venue to serve specific, not standardised tastes. Michael's friend Mary Howan was as good as her word, and as soon as we were up and running, she wrote a very favourable piece in The Guardian. She wrote, "Richard Strange brought the right touch of eccentric glamour to the proceedings. On stage, some murky drama is unfolding to the insistent rhythms of the tape machine. Strange gives a wonderfully stylish performance with just the right amount of caricature to keep the emotions in check." She followed up by bringing an entire BBC TV crew down to film an evening, an operation that was not done without a certain amount of attendant hassle. Many reviewers typically took the easy way out and described the club as decadent, but I never really thought it was. I mean, I was decadent, but I didn't think the club was. It was debauched, but not decadent. I acted as a conferencier as well as an occasional performer. Sometimes I would finish one or two songs solo, sometimes a short set with a pickup band. There were also times when, paralysed by drink, I would watch transfixed from the bar, a spectator at my own party, as the evenings seemed to run themselves. The regular audiences of 300 or more were drawn from an extraordinarily wide age range, anything from 17 to 50 on a typical night. The style was dressy and eccentric, but not elitist, and so was thought to be more relaxed than some of the contemporary peacock palaces in London. Sounds magazine wrote, "Civilization in a cellar in Soho. People of every stripe and none cram in without crushing each other, show mutual respect in the small courtesies they needed to keep a packed crowd sweet, flaunt their individualism, and yet point no fingers at the substantial majority in the crowd who do not make an extravagant visual statement about themselves." Its popularity and singular atmosphere meant that I had an extensive choice of performers who were keen to appear there. Since the entrance fee was only £1.50, budgets were tiny, and because there were so many performances each night, nobody was ever paid more than £25. The true and quintessential character of Cabaret Futura was indelibly established when the Event Group did their first show for me. The Event Group was a performing arts living theatre collective of indeterminate number based around the inspired visionary Tom Castle and the physically insane Mick Jones. In addition to the nucleus of these two, the group could also feature, for example, 8 electric bass players or 22 cricketers in full kit. After their first show, they were ever-present regulars who would seep into the club in the afternoon like a patch of damp to prepare for their evening show. They infiltrated the club like a virus, altering the space with installations, costumes, confrontation and cruelty. Sometimes they were like Antonin Artaud on absinthe, other times the Marquis de Sade on mandrax. One of their masterworks, Haircut, Sir, centred around a 4-hour-long head shaving of one unfortunate group member, lashed horizontally upside down to a pole like an awful scene from Lord of the Flies that had ended up on the censor's floor. As each of the other acts that night finished their set, it was very rare for anyone to play a set longer than 20 minutes, the lights would come up on the Event Group again in another part of the building, the soundtrack cranked up even louder to ultrasound, and the naked, writhing figure would be shorn of a few more locks. Another of their performances was "Run Out, They've Got Johnny." To the eerily repetitive percussion of a revolving cricket wicket, amplified like some Mephistophelian marimba through the PA, they performed a stylized game of cricket in full paraphernalia, which featured frenzied running at top speed through the packed club and a large quantity of fruit being thrown, sort of cricket ball meets Hugo ball. The late great gallerist Robert Fraser, veteran of the infamous Rolling Stones drug bust in the 60s, drinking at the bar with the artist Brian Clarke, regrettably got in the way of a flying Jaffa, catching it full in the face as it hurtled through the miasma. Incensed and lubricious after polishing off a couple of bottles of Bollinger, Fraser looked around for something to hurl back. Finding nothing to hand, he took off his exquisite handmade shoes and threw them at the man wielding the electric cricket bat with the immortal line, "Dada lives, you die," and walked off into the night barefoot. Untypically, He missed his target that time. He once speared an unfortunate Punjabi waiter with a dining fork from 10 metres across a crowded restaurant while ordering Bang Bang Chicken. Mick Jones survived that particular attack, but shortly afterwards, he was hit by a flying table. He was taken to hospital in need of stitches while still wearing his cricket pads and batting gloves. Alcohol was certainly the preferred drug at Cabaret Futura, so it's perhaps appropriate that Shane McGowan should have performed his first ever Pogue set there.
I've been loving you a long time, down all the years, down all the days, and I've cried for all your troubles. Smile at your funny little ways. We watched our friends grow up together.
Since hearing him that time, Shane has been one of my favourite songwriters. He has an exquisite lyrical gift and a highly original voice. The tragedy of his recent demise is all the more poignant because of his enormous, mainly wasted potential. His determination to join his Irish heroes in an orgy of self-destruction is almost too pitiful to witness. That night, a young Shane and his pal Spider Stacey stumbled to the stage with borrowed guitars and delivered a blistering, rollicking set of Irish rebel songs and protean Pogues ballads before yielding the spotlight to a traumatised young Mark Armand and Soft Cell. Mark, resplendent in red sequin two-piece and a pearl necklace, composed himself, picked up the gauntlet and played a memorable and haunting set with his partner Dave Ball. That night we all went home whistling Tainted Love and a Tricolour Ribbon.
Get away from the pain you drive into the heart.
An insane and exciting time. Paul Morley, who at that time was star journalist at the New Music Express and still had a fine sense of humour, appointed himself unofficial cheerleader for the Cabaret. For the whole lifetime of the club, he never again wrote an article for the New Music Express without somehow mentioning Cabaret. It was as if he was trying to make amends for the savagery of his tirade against Doctors of Madness. The great and the good and the merely desperately trendy flocked in. Some made it onto the guest list: William Burroughs, Keith Haring, David Bailey, Julian Cope, Harlan Ellison, Michael Moorcock. Others didn't: Richard Branson. On a good night, the club was incandescent. Keith Allen, stark naked on stage, delivered terrifying, seething stream of consciousness tirades. He was a palpably dangerous, thrilling act to watch. At that time, he was the nearest thing to Lenny Bruce that this country had ever produced. He was that good. Writers such as Anne Clark in her first ever live performance, Ken Hollings, Giovanni D'Adamo and Adrian Dannett read excerpts from their work in progress. Dannett, then 16 years old, now the New York-based art and opera pundit for a number of international publications, as well as one of the funniest men on earth, called himself Ezra Electric and wore a fetching velvet beret and matching pantaloons, evoking nothing so much as a 16-year-old Rembrandt. He was still flush from his TV success, starring as the eponymous hero in Just William. John Hegley and Simon Fanshawe, now stalwarts of BBC Radio, both performed solo stand-up spots to mixed approbation. The club was a great place for oddities, one-offs who fitted into neither the mainstream music camp nor into the precious self-satisfied world of high art. The sculptor Richard Wilson, nearly 6 years before he filled the Saatchi Gallery with sump oil in his magnificent installation work 2050, played to great acclaim at Cabaret Futura with the pyrotechnic noise merchants the Beau Gamelan. The shambolic good humour of the place saved the lives of many performers who would have been strung up by the balls at the more conservative and pompous ICA. One evening, the stage became Winston Churchill's operations bunker for the Disco Winston's only live performance. A portly chap with a cigar declaimed that "this was our finest hour," while four backing singers in the uniforms of the Allied and Axis armies performed an extraordinary and possibly illegal dance routine behind barbed wire. A thunder flash nearly removed the forearm of someone sitting close to the stage, and to top it all, thieves stole that night's takings from Jessopina and Sainsbury. As soon as word got out about this misfortune, someone organised a cash collection to make sure all the artists got paid and the snake got fed. It was that sort of place. It would have been impossible to sustain the furious intensity of Cabaret Futura for more than 6 months, so I closed it while the place was still blazing. Jessopina said later, the acts just got wilder and wilder, and short of actually throwing Christians to the lions, there was nowhere left for it to go. I was offered a large amount of money to set it up in the West End and do whatever I wanted, but I felt it had run its course in London. I toured the USA with a selection of the acts that had appeared at the club, but it was a disappointment in all ways but financial. Ultimately, the Cabaret was not a musical feast, but a luncheon on the grass of that London moment, given by those who performed there and who supported it so wholeheartedly. Even now, I'm often asked why I didn't start another club, just as Picasso was probably urged to bang out another Guernica, or Stravinsky cajoled into knocking off another Rite of Spring.